Okay, one of the questions you've got. So, we'll have a few more questions today than yesterday, so let's see how this comes out. So, question number one. About the holy life, why don't nunneries throughout Britain accept generally women in their 50s or 60s to be seminaries? I think the reason probably is many reasons for that, and one of the reasons is that if you have a lot of candidates, then you would probably like to emphasize those candidates that are likely to have a long monastic life ahead of them, who can become teachers in the long run, all these kind of things. And I guess the older you are, the more likely it will be you become a nun, and you kind of hang out in the monastery and do your meditation practice, but you might be less useful for the Buddhist society in general over the long run. Yeah? The more time you have to cultivate your mind from a young age, the more kind of flexible your mind is because you're young, the more ability you have to learn the teaching, the Dhamma properly, all of these kind of things. I think there is a preference for younger candidates, especially if you have a lot of people. Yeah. So I think that is why. So, I agree, it is unfortunate because really it should be open to everybody. Everybody should have a chance. It's not nice to feel that you are now past 50 or 60, so it's too late, yeah? If I were to ordain, that would be at the end of me. I wouldn't have a chance anymore. Over 50, yeah, so that's it. And it's kind of not so nice. I understand that. But I think that's what it comes down to. One of the interesting things the Buddha says about getting older is that he says, the older you are, the less ability you have to follow the rules in the monastery, yeah, the rules of training, yeah, because our minds are less flexible, all these kind of things. Yeah. So old people are more like, why are these youngsters telling me what to do? Yeah, I'm like their mother, I'm like their father, and they're telling me what to do? Okay, enough of this, I'm not gonna abide by this or whatever. Yeah. And that is the reality. The older you are, the more kind of settled we tend to be in our ways, etc., etc. So I think that is the preference is given to those women below age 50. Yeah, exactly. So, but sometimes it can't hurt to apply. Yeah, sometimes exemptions are made. You know, if you want to go to a monastery like the Mansara Monastery in Perth, I know they have an age limit there, but it's a little bit flexible. So if you go there and you hang out, yeah, don't tell you, I told you this, this is a kind of secret information, yeah. So if you are over 50 and you really are keen on getting ordained there, go there, hang out for a while, stay there for the rains retreat, show what a marvelous community member you are, you know, how willing you are to help out in the kitchen, to work hard, that you're physically still strong, even though you are not a spring chicken anymore, yeah? you're still okay, and you are a good community member. If you can prove to them that you are a good candidate, then you can maybe ask for exceptional circumstances, and they may actually ordain you. It's more difficult as well if you are from Malaysia and you want to ordain, it's more difficult because of visas and all these kind of things, additional problems as well. But they have ordained one nun at our monastery who was actually quite old. She must be well over 70 now. Venerable Gautami, you know her, yeah? Yeah, she's the sister of Padma Widow in Akshay, yeah. And she is ordained down there. And one of the reasons we ordained her, but she was such a strong supporter of Bodhidharma Monastery for so many years, yeah? Coming every week, supporting the monks, always very interested in Dhamma and meditation. Then her husband died, and so she kind of, what to do now, yeah? So the life is kind of coming to an end. And so she asked to be ordained. And because of all the circumstances together, she accepted her. So it is always circumstance. Nothing is ever set in concrete, yeah? Except for anicca, dukkha, anatta. That's set in concrete. Everything else is kind of flexible. Yeah? Okay, Anna, question. Can a person diagnosed with major clinical depression do practice meditation? Already weaned off medication for depression, but still counseled by a psychiatrist. Yes, I think people with depression can do that. I think depression is one of the kind of the mental illnesses, which actually are quite, meditation often is quite useful, because you learn just to rest, you learn to be at ease, you learn to relax, and it can be very useful. I know that in certain, like the NHS in England, in the UK, the National Health Service over there, they actually use meditation practice as one of the ways of treating, in particular, depression. So I think it can be very useful, it can help people a lot. But if you are depressed very often, you find it very tiring to be around people, for example. And socializing is difficult, you know, all these kind of things. You want to withdraw back into yourself a lot if you have depression. So by closing your eyes, like you are withdrawing into yourself a little bit, it means you have more time to relax and be at ease if you have this kind of condition. So I think it can be very useful. Help people who are depressed, help them find a nice guided meditation. For everybody, this is very useful, especially if you are depressed. Otherwise, you just kind of go into this state and you kind of stay there for half an hour. Nothing really happens because your mind, when you're depressed, you don't think or don't think very much. Your mind is kind of very slow and doesn't really, nothing much happens very often. Get them a nice guided meditation, which is very positive reinforcement, perhaps a bit of metta, yeah? If you're depressed, what you need to do is you need to learn to look at the world in a new way. Why do people get depressed? Because they feel bad about themselves. They feel that they aren't good enough. They have a negative impression of themselves, or they have a negative impression of the world. Or they feel that they have no power to affect things. They feel kind of impotent in their life, yeah? Can't do anything with life. And all of these things are what makes you depressed. So you need to reinvent the way you think, in a sense. You learn to look at things in a new way, in a more positive way. That is a lot of the problem of depression, and it can be changed a lot through that. This is why, using a counselor can often be helpful if they are very skilled at what they are doing. And meditation can also be part of that. I really love to talk today about Kalyanamitta. Okay, I had a lot of fun and friendly and sweet moments when I was around my close friend with whom I can share my stories and Dhamma and frankly. But wouldn't it be a hindrance to be considered as sensual pleasure? I don't think so. I'm not sure exactly what you mean by sensual pleasure here. You mean listening to the Dhamma? You mean sharing Dhamma with your friend? You have a lot of fun and friendliness with your friend? I don't think that's a problem. Yeah, it's good. Please have fun. I want you to have fun. It's good to have fun. Yeah, you need to relax a little bit, just to enjoy life. It's so important. So, mess around, be silly, enjoy things. Don't take things too seriously. Just relax and enjoy. And if the Dhamma, even with the Dhamma, you can relax and enjoy it. Don't take it too seriously. And if you do that, then I think when Dhamma becomes fun, that's when it becomes really interesting. That's when it kind of enriches our life in a very powerful way. This is not really what we mean by sensual pleasures. Sensual pleasure is more like, you're married and you kind of have lots of mistresses or whatever on the side. That's kind of sensual pleasures, yeah? That's where there is a problem. So don't kind of take these things too far, because that is where we lose our kind of what makes it fun in life to practice these teachings. If you keep your five precepts, yeah, that is really the baseline for what sensual pleasures you should not overstep. The five precepts gives a clear guideline as to what you can do and what you can't do. If you keep that, you're already doing really well there. That is really where it is at. A lot of people in the world have problems with the five precepts. If you can do that, wonderful. Beyond keeping the five precepts, really your job is to be kind. Yeah? So this is great. This is exactly that. You're kind, you're having fun, you are enjoying the Dhamma. Wonderful. It's great. People sometimes ask me, what about listening to music? Is that evil in the Buddhist teachings? Very evil to listen to music. Yeah? Whoa, so evil. It is not evil. Yeah? Listening to music is nothing. If you use music in the right way, there's a little bit of sensuality in music, but it really depends on what kind of music it is. Some music is not all that sensual, and some is more sensual. But when you come back home after a long day, you know, whatever it is that you do, you come back home and you just want to relax a little bit because you find yourself being a bit tense or whatever. Put on some nice music that makes you feel more relaxed. Maybe a bit of chanting, yeah? Or a bit of, just doesn't even have to be chanting, some nice clap piano music or whatever it is. It just makes you feel more at ease. It is not very essential. It's not going to be a big hindrance. And then if you want to do some meditation later on, probably turn the music off and then you continue your meditation practice. Use these things skillfully. Don't play heavy metal music, yeah? It's not going to be very useful for you. You get the wrong kind of mood or whatever. So feel what works for you. What is effective in your life. This is so important. Whatever works is what is useful. Then you are on the right track. Wait in there.
Venerable Sir, for the third precept, Kame Su Vichachara, we know that it's from the word karma, which means sense, the five senses.
Yep.
How did that get related to just sexual misconduct in the sutta? I haven't come across it.
It actually stated in certain places, yeah, that the Kame Su Vichachara actually refers to that. I think it's not many places, maybe only once or twice in the sutta. So that is indeed the implication according to that. I agree with you. When you read, it's very hard to know what it refers to. Yeah, misconduct in the sexual pleasure. Exactly what does that mean? That seems to be actually the record, at least in one place in the sutta. So that is quite clearly mentioned. And also remember that when the five priests have become the eight priests, they become the brahmacharya. Yeah, and that obviously refers to sexuality. Yeah. So, in that case, because of the sexuality there, you can assume it also must be something to do with sexuality in the third precept, ordinary of the time as well. That is what it revolves around. I think other kinds of sexuality are easier to deal with. They are not so bad. Yeah, they are not so powerful in a sense. That's why they are easy to deal with. That is the one which is where the power of the defilement is the strongest, and that's why this can be the most hard to kind of restrain yourself sometimes. Depending on the person, for some people it's not so hard, for some people incredibly hard. Yeah, depends on your background, your conditioning, and all of these kind of things.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Yes.
Ajahn, first, thank you so much for your kindness and compassion. We can all see that you are not feeling well, but you still continue to be blessed. Thank you so much. I recently came back from a Dhamma Yatra in India, and I was very inspired, so I started my own sutta reflection. So I was using a book by Bhikkhu Munindu on the Dhammapada, and there were very succinct reflection suggestions there in the book. And I find that when I go deeper into the meaning of the certain verse, I attain certain insights. I was like, that's what it means, and that's how it relates to me. So I have two questions relating this. One is, it gets me to a deep sense of peace, and I can go into meditation very easily, because I just want to sit and contemplate on, let's say, a word or a sentence, and that leads me to deeper meditation. So I find that I am using that to go into meditation, rather than just sitting and focusing on the in and out of breathing. So is that advisable, or should I really break away from solely using sutta to achieve meditation? The second question is, how do I self-validate these insights such that I don't get the sort of wrong insights when I do these reflections?
Is it okay to use reflection to kind of get your samadhi and meditation started? And yes, very, very, absolutely valid. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing to do. It doesn't matter where the samadhi or the meditation comes from. If it helps you to become peaceful and relaxed and mindful, it is always positive. In fact, the whole idea of understanding the Buddha, of the right view, and reflecting in the right way, is precisely to achieve the sort of thing that you're talking about. And the reason is because when you understand the Dhamma, you actually let it go a little bit. And you start to understand where happiness, real happiness lies, and you let go of those things that are not real happiness. So if it is a real insight, a real understanding, it's always very useful for meditation practice. So please continue doing that. But what you can do as well is you can, you know, you use that a little bit, and then once you kind of have established a little bit of peace, you can let it go, and then you can kind of go to your meditation afterwards. So you start off with reflecting or reading, and then you close your eyes and you continue with your meditation afterwards, watching the breath or whatever it is that you do. So you do one thing after the other. And I often recommend people to use a guided meditation. I know that very often when you come in a group like this, it's easy for people to meditate because you have an atmosphere, you have people come together. When you go back home, actually quite difficult to recreate that atmosphere. Yeah, so when you go back home, even if you have a room that is kind of your the place where you do your meditation practice, it can be good to listen to a nice guided meditation. It's in the right mood, the right frame of mind. That is going to be very helpful. How do you know that your insights are valuable? And the way to do that is to remember that any true, real insight helps you to let go. So because it helps you to let go, it makes you more peaceful. Because it makes it more peaceful, it allows your meditation to progress. So if it is a true insight, it deepens your samadhi, it deepens your mindfulness, it deepens your ability to practice meditation, essentially. This is one of those very important things to remember, because insight in Buddhism is always insight into the three characteristics. Understanding where happiness and suffering are, understanding where impermanence is, and because we understand these things, we let go of those things in the world that stop us from being peaceful. It happens automatically when you have the right insight. So this is why in the suttas you always see sammatha and vipassana always come as a pair. Sammatha, and that is precisely because these are two sides of the same coin. If you see things clearly, that's what you're doing when you're reading the Dhammapada verse. You say, oh, now I understand. That's a moment of clarity when you see things clearly. That's what vipassana is. Sammatha always comes together with that. If you have sammatha, if you have success in your meditation practice, you become more calm, then seeing clearly comes together with that calm. It's the other side of the coin of the calm. Sammatha vipassana always comes together. Sometimes people talk about vipassana meditation, sammatha meditation, but really all meditation is both sammatha and vipassana, because they both come together, they arise together. Okay? Yeah? Good. Okay. Okay, next one. Question, is this right unit? I tend to compare the Christian God concept with the Buddhist your life is in your hands, the karma rebirth concept. It is so easy to leave everything to a savior when we feel so down and weary. Yes, I agree with you, and this is, I think, part of the problem. Yeah, this is part of the problem why a religion with a creator God or a God which kind of interferes in our life is so attractive in a sense, because you just believe in God and that's it. Yeah? End of story. Everything is kind of happy ever after. It reminds me of my father. My father was a businessman. He traveled everywhere in the world. And one year he came to Malaysia, probably here in KL somewhere, I assume, maybe in Penang. And he, you know, after kind of they had a business dinner, and there was a lady there sitting at the table. And they started talking about religion. This is a long time ago, 20, 30 years ago. 30 years ago, probably at least. 40 years ago, who knows? And my father asked her what kind of religion she was. And she said she was a Christian. And she had converted from Buddhism. And my father asked her why. And she said, well, Christianity is so much more real. Yeah, don't have to do anything. No precepts. All you have to do is believe in God, and that's it. Yeah, the God will look after the rest. It is a good deal if it's true, but if it isn't true, it's a pretty bad deal. Yeah, it's really terrible. So this is the problem with this. But I agree with you. I think that this idea of the savior, this is precisely why it is so attractive, because it kind of makes things easy. I don't have to do anything, yeah? Okay, it's good to be nice, sure, okay, whatever, but in the end, it is the faith that really matters from a Christian point of view. So, but it is also not very realistic. And let's face it, the world doesn't work like that. The world doesn't work. I can do whatever I want, and then somebody comes and kind of helps me out. And kind of, you know, things aren't like that. In our life right now, we know it doesn't work. Like, if you don't behave well, bad things happen to you. If you behave well, good things happen to us. If you behave really badly, you go to jail. Yeah? This is just the way the world is. So it doesn't fit with our understanding of the world. And this is the problem with the kind of the God concept, in my opinion. There's something very beautiful that happens when you kind of let go of that concept and you go to the idea of karma instead. And that is that you start to feel empowered. The problem with the God concept, if God is in charge of everything, yeah, it means that in the end, God is also really responsible for everything. And there's nothing much that we can do. And it disempowers you. You feel more like a little puppet in the world. Yeah, you're kind of strings being pulled around. You kind of follow whatever the Creator God has kind of decided for you. You're very powerless. It can lead to lots of problems if you go down that line. If once you get released from that idea of the Creator God, and you get into the Buddha, that it actually empowers you, suddenly you are fully in charge of your life. If you take the reins of your life properly and you kind of grasp the rein, then you start to guide yourself in the right way, you can create everything you want in this life. Create your own happiness, create whatever it is. And this is the beautiful thing about the Buddhist teachings, that it actually does empower us. It's scary because we feel that we haven't got full understanding yet. But it's scary. But once you get over the little scary thing, it's very empowering. This is why it is, I think, so useful. The Buddha says in a sutta we'll have a look at later on, but the Pala Sutta, he says that there is no shelter, there is no Lord in the world, there is no God in the world. We have to kind of sort things out ourselves. Okay, so good. Yes? Piranda, what is your take on the latest tradition of Buddhism? Vajrayana, as popularized by Hollywood and the Lama, it seems to be easier than the austere Theravada. I don't teach austere Theravada. You know, as a Ram doesn't teach that, it's happy Theravada. Yeah? Relax, chill, enjoy life, yeah. Enjoy your meditation practice, not kind of sit cross-legged for too long. Actually, that reminds me, I should put my legs down. And this is one of the reasons why it is important not to get the wrong end of the stick, even with a Theravada tradition, not to kind of take it too seriously and take it the wrong way. I think it's so important that we enjoy our practice. Yes, a lot of the people are into Vajrayana these days. You travel around, people are really interested in Tibetan teachings. I don't really get it, to be honest with you. I don't understand why they're so interested in Tibetan teachings myself. But the problem with the Tibetan teachings, there's a lot of good things with them. The good thing is that they have a lot in common with Theravada. I'm being naughty. A lot of common in Theravada, yeah, because a lot of the basic things in Buddhism are the same across the board. When you start to read things like the Dalai Lama has taught, you realize a lot of the things that he teaches are very core things in Buddhism, yeah, watching the breath meditation, being kind, all these kind of things. It's barely distinguishable from what we do as Theravada Buddhists. Almost exactly the same thing. So of course, then there is no problem. Yeah, we can coexist with the Vajrayana people, and it's very easy to appreciate each other on that basis. The biggest problem with Vajrayana, and it's actually exactly the same problem with Theravada as well, is that we often tend to focus on later teachings rather than the early teachings. The problem also exists in Theravada. Yeah, we focus on Abhidhamma, we focus on Visuddhimagga, we focus on Jataka stories, yeah? Put up plays of the Visantara Jataka, Buddhist world is full of that kind of stuff. And that is what we focus on, and we forget the early sutras. And that, so we are making, in fact, exactly the same problem, the same mistake in Theravada Buddhism as they do in Vajrayana Buddhism, because there too they focus on later teachers, yeah? Milarepa and Dzogchen and all this other kind of stuff, perhaps a long time after the Buddha. So it is a similar kind of position really here. And I don't think it is the right way to think about Buddhism in terms of Theravada versus Vajrayana versus Mahayana. I think the better way of thinking about Buddhism is in terms of early Buddhism versus later Buddhism. And then we can take away this kind of sectarian tendency that somehow we are better than the other one. Actually, we are all affected by similar kind of problems, regardless what kind of Buddhism we come from. So we all need to ask ourselves more, what did the Buddha say? Yeah, who is the teacher we all have in common? It is the Buddha. If you ask even the famous Master Yinshun, you know Master Yinshun, famous Mahayana teacher from Taiwan. He was born in China, went to Taiwan at the right time of the revolution in China, 1949 or whatever, he stayed to Taiwan and stayed there. Very, very influential monk in Taiwan. He was the one who is very much the inspiration behind the 4-1 Shan and the Dharma Renown and all the big kind of sects in Taiwan. And he was one of the most well-studied of all the Mahayana monks of that generation. Really, really well-studied monk. Very, very highly respected. And he also basically agreed that the Agamas, that is the earliest part of the Buddha's teachings. Yeah? So even the Mahayana tradition basically agree on this. Everybody understands this. So that is really the kind of the, I think, we all have that in common, but regardless of who we are as Buddhists, the early teachings are the same for everyone. And if we can go back to those, then we have commonality, something that we can agree on, something that we can actually work with. That, I think, is the most important part. Even the Tibetans, if you say that they are real teachers in the sutras, they will agree with you on that, because they also recognize that these sutras are the most ancient part of the Buddhist heritage. So let's make friends with each other, yeah, with the Vajrayana and everyone, because we have so much in common. And please don't make your Theravada practice too austere, because then I may never see you again here when I come back next time. You may have what is called defected to some other tradition. Dear Ajahn, could you please explain the base of nothingness versus the base of neither perception nor perception? Thank you. Okay, these things are quite hard to explain, yeah? It doesn't really kind of lend itself to explanation very well. It's like even just a jhana state, yeah? Very hard to explain, really. Yeah? Just feel bliss, enormous amounts of bliss. That's what it feels like, these things. And the explanation actually very quite hard. So these are stages of samadhi. Imagine that you go through the jhanas, yeah, and all you experience is bliss. There's nothing but bliss. That's all there is. Hour after hour after hour, it's feeling pure bliss. Bliss that is so strong that you never experience anything like it in your whole life. Like Ajahn Brahm says, I can't take it anymore. It's just so much bliss, yeah. I don't know how I can possibly take this. It's too much. That's kind of the jhana state. And then there comes a point when you think, let me see if I can go beyond this. Yeah? I mean, already at this point, you experience so much bliss that you think, how can there possibly be anything beyond this? This is just already absolutely astonishing. Try to go beyond that. You let go of the bliss. And when you let go of the bliss, you enter even deeper states of samadhi. This is where the immaterial attainments are. Yeah? When you let go of the bliss, there's almost nothing left. All that is left, first of all, is you have the base of infinite space, yeah? So you have a perception of infinite space, that's your perception. Space without boundaries. I don't know, you can try to imagine what that is like, but it's kind of hard to imagine. Then you have infinite consciousness. What is that experience like? Very hard to understand what it means. Then comes nothingness. infinite space already sounds pretty much like nothingness, but now it's real nothingness, yeah? This really is nothing. You have the perception of nothing. It's very hard to get your mind around these things. You really have to, the only way to really understand what these things are is to get there, yeah? So I'm going to use the carrot, you see. You have to get there, and then you can start experiencing these things. And then, after you have experienced nothing, you go to another one which is even more refined, yeah? And you don't really, it is so refined that you don't really know whether you are perceiving or not. Am I perceiving or not perceiving? You just don't know. You can't think that while you're there, but you can think that afterwards when you come out of these things. Neither perception nor non-perception. You haven't got a clue what is going on, basically. What happened? It was just so profound, that's all we know, but you don't really know what it was. That's the state of neither perception nor non-perception. So it's really weird, it's very, very strange, but very profound and very beautiful, of course. And once you get there, not many people have been there. Yeah, it's incredibly rare to find anyone who's ever been to this place. But once you get there, you start to understand what is going on. Okay, I'm afraid I can't really do very well. Try Ajahn Brahm when he comes, see what he says. He's much more experienced with meditation than I am, so he can give you some more really profound answers, perhaps. So. Imagine, if someone who has been inflicted by spirits or charms, if he or she utters harsh or unwholesome speech, does that constitute in breaking the fourth precept? Thank you, Madam. If someone is afflicted by a spirit and they are not in their right mind, they are like crazy, yeah, or their mind is not out of control, then no, it doesn't constitute breaking the fourth precept. If you are a monk or a nun, you can break any precept you like if you are nuts. If you're crazy, then any precept you break is not actually an issue now. But don't use that as an excuse, right? Sorry, I'm being naughty. You have to, because when you're crazy, you're out of your mind. You don't know what you're doing anymore. So you are not responsible for your act. Just like in law, yeah? If you do a bad, if you murder someone while you're crazy, usually you don't get in prison for that because you were crazy at the time. So legally, it's exactly the same thing. Yeah? So, yes. So that's really, yeah. Last question for tonight. Dear Ajahn, can you please give some pointers on short 20-minute self-compassion, self-forgiveness meditation? I carry a burden of guilt with me for over 2 decades. Okay. So, the point of the most important things to be able to forgive oneself, but also not just oneself, but also others, is to remember this thing that I was saying before, that we are entirely conditioned as people. Yeah? What we do in this life comes from the past, sometimes deep in the past lives. We can't even see where some of these things come from. So if you did something silly 2 decades ago, yeah, then you did something silly, now you feel bad about that. Remember, you're now looking back, yeah, and you're kind of looking back into the past, and very often when we kind of look back like that, we look back to the distorted past. Yeah, we don't see things as it actually is anymore. We feel guilty because we think, I could have done things differently. This is the problem. The point is, probably you couldn't have done things differently. You were compelled by your defilements, compelled by your conditioning, compelled by all of these things that you are not in control of. That compelled you to do this act. And now, in retrospect, you think, oh, I should have done differently. But actually, retrospect is lying to you. Retrospect is never the truth. In retrospect, you can never actually recreate the precise situation that was there. In retrospect, you feel, wow, you know, now I understand. But actually, you don't understand the retrospect. Retrospect is never the truth. So forget about that. You can be almost absolutely sure you could not have done anything different in that situation because the conditioning was so strong. You may not believe that. Maybe you believe that you actually could have done differently. Why do you believe that? And the reason you believe that you could have done differently is because of the sense of self inside of you. That's why you believe that. It feels like we are in control, yeah? It feels like we are in charge and we have choices. I can choose either A or I can choose B. Somebody up there, either the doctor on my talk or the doctor, I'm sure.
Love it.
They're agreeing. Hundreds, okay? So it feels that way, and because it feels that way, we get deluded into thinking that we could have done differently here. That is why you feel guilty, because you feel you had a choice and you didn't make the right choice. But you are not, you didn't have a choice. You were acting out your conditions and causes of the past. That's why you ended up doing something stupid. This is very, very powerful. If you're able to get into this mind frame and looking at the world this way, there is nobody you cannot forgive. You can forgive everyone in your entire life, yeah? Absolutely everyone. The worst kind of mass murderers in the world, the worst people in your life, you can forgive them. Why? Because they are running on a program. They are running on causes and conditions that were laid down in the past, but they have no choice in the way they are acting. Once you see that, it becomes sad almost, yeah? You see all these people doing bad things in the world, doing negative things. They are causing so much suffering for themselves because they're creating so much bad karma. But they have no choice. They have to act out in this way. Why? Because they haven't heard the Buddha's teachings. They haven't got any input in wisdom. All they are doing is this program is driving them forward, and they have no other choice than what they're doing. Think like this. This way you can forgive others, you can forgive yourself. It is a very, very powerful way of looking at the world. It all comes from the Buddhist idea of non-self. If you fully understand non-self, it means you also fully understand that in the end, we don't have any choice. You're just doing things because of conditions and causes. Don't be fooled by the feeling you have inside that you have a choice. That is the illusion. That is part of the illusion of the self, yeah? And don't be fooled by it. And then you are starting to understand what is going on. Very often, it is not so much that these things can be resolved through meditation practice. A lot of these things need to be resolved by reflecting in the right way. The Buddha talks about two types of development of the mind, two types of balla, two types of powers. One is the pachavekana balla, one is the bhavana balla. Pachavekana means to reflect, the power of reflection. And the purpose of the power of reflection, says the Buddha, is to overcome unwholesome actions like body, speech, and mind. Yeah? We don't overcome the unwholesome. And this includes guilt. Guilt is not really wholesome. It is a negative thing. So we're trying to overcome that. Overcome always by reflection, not by developing the mind in meditation practice. The meditation practice, the bhavana, the power of development, that is all to do with the four jhanas, the seven factors of awakening, all about meditation practice. That is a much deeper state. Before that, to overcome your anger, your desires, overcome your bad actions, that body, speech, and mind, all of that is done through right reflection, thinking about the world in the right way. If you consistently think wisely, if you consistently challenge your habits the way you are, eventually you will be able to overcome anger in your life. Do you believe that, sir? Yeah? Well, okay, good. Good on you. That is great. Because it is basically true. I've seen that in myself, yeah? I used to be a much, much more angry person all day than I am now. Gradually coming down, less and less and less, as you apply the Dhamma teachings in the right way. Okay, so that is all for tonight, yeah? So, are you happy with the new schedule ending a bit earlier? Is that a good idea? Yes? Okay, great. Gives you a bit more time to get back home and have dinner and all these kind of things. I know you have many, many things that you need to do. So let's just pay respect for the Buddha Dhamma Sangha and then we'll call it a day.